I'm Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. Sober through the grace of God, sponsorship in AA since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. This is very cool. It's really nice to be here. I want to congratulate Larry and Pat and Tom and Jim and Brooks and the people who put this together. Dallas should have a roundup. It's too great a place, too good a AA. The Lone Star was always a great roundup. And I think that's a small lesson that we all need to learn in AA, too. We always think it'll be there forever. We think our groups will be there forever. We think, you know, and if we don't take care of it, you know, it might not be there forever. So it is important what we do, and it is important that we all take responsibility and that we don't just assume that someone else is going to be doing it. I have so many connections in this room. It is really something. A lot of memories. I love Texas AA. David and Grace Aronofsky, you know, David got sober about 6 months ahead of me. We were great friends. I used to come down here all the time. I gave one of the early talks in AA at the 24-hour club. You know, David was supposed to talk, and he had me talk that night, and I was sober about 5 or 6 years, and that was a big deal for me. 1975, I walked into the Hot Springs, Arkansas to give an AA talk at a conference, and met Bob White. And Bob was my, and Bob subsequently introduced me to Jerry Jones and Bob Wildman and different connected me to Texas. And I can remember him telling me about these guys that he sponsored, and he wanted me to meet them, and how, you know, I can remember when Marceline called up my wife and said, we want you to come down, gave her a date, and Linda said, well, I think Bob's busy. And she said, well, I didn't invite Bob, I invited you. And and she said, well, I've got the kids. And she said, well, bring the kids. And Linda said, no one wanted our children. And they were really wonderful with couples. As Texas has some of the best family recovery and family afterwards things that I've run into any place in the United States. And Marceline said a very wise thing. I think if you and the kids come down, Bob will find a way to be there. At that time, I would have paid my way to any place in the world to give an AA talk. And that was a big deal for me. I was out, you know, trying to get everybody's attention. And and the impact of that man on my life was extraordinary. He was my Chamberlain. You know, as we talk about, there were very few men that were as powerful as Chuck C. and Bob White in a room with 30 people. They were just as strong a man because they had lived it. And Texas has a great common sense to their AA. A great grounding to their AA, a great centering in the book, and yet a practicality with how, to me, how they practice the program, and it's been an attractive thing. I was supposed to be at a wedding tonight for one of the guys I went to high school with, for his daughter, and he has 36 years in AA. I called on him 36 years ago, and I wish I could be at that wedding, but my wife's at it, and my son, who has 17 years of AA, or no, I don't know, something like that. And so, lots of memories. Debbie, your talker Friday night, I was in AA when she walked into Minnesota. So I saw her very often through the first 4 years of her sobriety, and we were very active in service. I knew Vinoy before they added a V to her name. But I can remember being in Amarillo or Lubbock or someplace that time that Jim took off, sitting on the steps having a conversation with you. We shared, and I remember being in Bob White's house when Bob died. So this is cool. I love Texas. I've had a home in Texas for 25 years, right down to Lake Whitney, and I've bought that home with Jerry when Bob died. Kind of a funny time to buy it, but I figured if I didn't stay connected. I was going to lose my contact with the people, and the people here are important to me. And it's been a nice part of my life. I started drinking when I was a freshman in high school. I was 4'11", 95 pounds, mostly mouth. I was an insecure kid. I went to a military school and a college campus. We were in uniforms, very strict military. I was a problem kid through grade school. Didn't think I wasn't a bad kid. I just couldn't sit still and I couldn't keep my mouth shut. I was today they'd say I was attention deficit. Then they just said I was a little ass. And you know, I just was always in trouble. Not bad stuff, just stuff. And I got thrown out, or sent home. I spent 2 months in the principal's office. Just, you know, that kind of stuff. And when I went to St. Thomas, which is the military school I went to, we drank in high school like most people drink in college. We had fraternities. Of my five closest buddies, four are in AA and one's in Al-Anon. Of a class of 117, we have 12 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a lot of alcoholism. We had a lot of recovery. I mean, that is, a lot of Irish Catholics. They had kids come from all over the United States and Central America. It was a boarding school, and we had, I love that. It was a good school, and I still see, I live in the same town that I was growing up in, never let me know I could leave. It was very Catholic, large clans, you know, so families were friends of families. They had 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 kids, you know. And so you often, you know, your whole range of brothers and sisters were friends of other families of a whole range of brothers and sisters. I suspect Louisville was much like that. And that's what's cool today. I mean, they walk and they know you're a Bazan. They don't know which one. They don't know who you're related to. But, you know, they just know that somehow, you know, you're connected. And that's nice. So it's like a village. It kind of assists. I love drinking. I just... my heroes. My father and his friends were my heroes. Those were the men that came back after the Second World War and made life look easy. You know, they were active in their communities. They were, you know, hard drinkers, hard players, hard workers. You know, they built communities, and they were very attractive to me. And cocktail parties were the order of the day. And I think we played house, you know. And in my day, if you could dress up in a suit, they'd serve you. I never reached puberty till I was 40. And I mean, that was one of the things I wanted. I was so small. I remember praying that I wanted to have more hair on my body, and I wanted to be heavier. I just didn't know they would grant that about 2 weeks ago. I was kind of hoping for it, I was kind of hoping that it come through in high school, but it never happened. But we drank our brains out, made false IDs, got arrested, got in car accidents, and we just had a hell of a time. And by the time I finished high school, and a couple of us almost died. Alcohol poisoning, you know. I mean, we did it up pretty good. We're pretty serious drinking for high school drinking. And I went away to school. Thought my drinking would become normal. Thought I'd get away from my old man and the police. And, you know, I went to Notre Dame, as Tim talked about today. And the talks have been terrific. I enjoyed very much hearing Ken. I had heard that Debbie was remarried and happily remarried, which was very cool, and it was better being unhappily remarried, I think. Than... And Vinoy, I've always loved. Tim was the talk I came to hear this morning. I don't know. You know, you go to a conference and there's 8 talks, and I've listened to Tim's talk on tape, but there was some very special stuff for me today, and you just connect. It just depends on where you are. I've been in kind of a flat spot. And things haven't been going, I don't know why, you know, no particular deal. You just, you know, you walk this road for 30 or 40 years, you're going to hit some flat spots in the road, and you do your best. I think I'm getting ready to do some more step work and kind of get out of the trench that I've been digging. And so when you go to a conference, there's always, to me, one or two talks that kind of connect you, and one of them will probably be tomorrow morning with Steve, so that's cool. And so I went away to Notre Dame, and I became the class drunk. And it was really important to me. You know, the status in high school was whether you were a jock, good-looking, and, you know, how you were with the ladies. Then all of a sudden, when everybody figured out after high school there was college. Then it was kind of like, where are you going to college? And most of the people in the college, the high school I went to did. And then which one were you going to? That gave you some status. So it was a big deal going to Notre Dame. I mean, I gave that away. They said, donate that. You know, I donated it. I was a daily drinker. I was a gambler. I was a thief. I started stealing when I was in grade school from my old man. I'd buy candy in prodigious amounts. I think our physiology, the physiology of alcoholics is different. My mom and dad had 21 grandchildren. In my family, there's two of us that are in AA, the other two boys in my immediate family. I have two cousins in AA. We have like seven kids who are attention deficit. I think we just have, I have two of my three kids are attention deficit. I just think our physiologies are different. I think our level of discomfort. When I took my first drink, man, I mean, it was just, Tim talked about that today. The level of comfort I experienced, I was in pain. Didn't know I was in pain. I thought, that everybody went else to it. It seemed like everybody else knew more about the living of life than I knew about the living of life. And when I took that drink, I mean, whatever discomfort I had just disappeared. It just disappeared. Why wouldn't you go back and do that as often as you could? I mean, it's nuts. I mean, we talk about it like it doesn't work and drugs and all this sort of thing. And I think most of the people that use drugs today, they just never understood what a wonderful drug alcohol was. I mean, God. For the bang for your buck, baby. It is wonderful. But so many of the kids, as my children, Linda and I, I'll get into later, we have three boys. They are 26, 34, and 37. They have 8, 15, and 19 years of sobriety. I've turned my wife in as a carrier. None of us were alcoholic when we met her. So I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19 years old. I was, once or twice a year, I got in kind of a death deal. I'd crack up a car, I'd get arrested, I'd get shot at, or something happened to me. And I mean, I was in trouble, and they were trying to get me help. And I got diagnosed when I was 19. I thought that was goofy. I went down to school, read some books on alcoholism, and I talked about alcoholism and latent homosexuality. I wanted no part about, I was unwilling to face alcoholism, much less latent homosexuality. I later found out that was kind of a Freudian-based idea, and my psychiatrist said he didn't follow that school. I walked out of Notre Dame middle of my senior year. Rudy went through Notre Dame. Rudy attended Notre Dame. I passed through. I started out as a B student and ended up as a, 2.0000. I went to school one day a week, maybe. I was supporting myself with gambling. I'm drinking every day. I go to, I went down and talked to the priest the day about the time I was leaving, and he just said, "Why don't you just go try? Go back to your room and just try." And I didn't know where my classes were. No, but think of that. I did not know where my classes were. I mean, later I was to find out that there is such a thing as karma, and I was going to have these little crap heads that I was their parent of, and they were going to go to my middle boy went to 5 colleges, and he never got the concept of attending until the 3rd college, which was in Texas, St. Edward's. Before I forget, those two women who had the one day. That's very cool. Congratulations. That was Shelley and Tammy. We have that tradition where we give books away, and usually we're not so flaky that we can't find the books. Tim has been walking around with the books most of the weekend. I'm sure we will come up with them. But one of the twists I hope we do in that tradition is I hope that the person who receives that book with the 1 year will come back next year and along with the old timer, give it to the next person who has 1 year. So you have 1 year. And if that's true, this could be a wonderfully important day for you. This could be your sobriety day. And it would be wonderful for all of us to think that you would come back and celebrate your birthday with us on an annual basis. So I walked out of, I didn't know where my classes were. I mean, that's, you have to be an ass to not know. I mean, you do. I mean, that is about on the outward edge of, I was due to be commissioned. I had to get a medical release or I would have been drafted during the Vietnam deal. I got a medical release for alcoholism. I was, so that's not bad. I came home, I finished school at a local university. When I finished school, my father asked me to leave the house. He said, "Bob, we love you. We just can't deal with you. You know, there's 7 kids in the family. You're just, you don't follow any rules. We're just having too many troubles. Good luck." And got a job at a liquor store. And have to use your gifts. And so this is the last year of my drinking. And I, this is Vietnam's on. I'm trying to get into an officer candidate school. Then a guard unit opened up, and it turns out that I failed the physical. I've taken the physical 4 times, and they failed me the 4th time. So I get a job at the liquor store. I'm stealing booze. I'm working at the liquor store. I get fired after 3 or 4 months at the liquor store. I start working as a waiter. I'm living not quite on Skid Row, but tacky would be the word, that you would. I'm shacked up with waiters and waitresses and people that, Dr. Seuss, that child author, those are actual photographs of people I live with during the last year of my drinking. And my family hadn't seen me in a heck of a long time, and that was fine with me. I was pretty ashamed of how I was conducting myself and what I was doing. I went to a party one night, and I got my face kicked in, and I got fired as a waiter. And I was tapped. I had no place to go, and I went back to my dad, and I asked if I could move back in the house, and he allowed me to do so on the condition that I wouldn't drink. And I guess I lied, because I couldn't stop. I tried to stop drinking, went into hallucinations. I am 23 years old. I have an enlarged liver. I'm drinking about 1/5 a day, most every day for the last year. Didn't know you'd get in trouble not drinking, but, that was not a good idea, stopping abruptly. When I moved back in the house, I really tried to change my life. I hated being I can't tell you how many nights I cried myself to sleep listening to my parents fight or argue about what to do with me. They were at their wits' ends. Those family meetings where the police would bring you home or you'd be in the hospital, your brothers and sisters would be yelling, your mother would be hysterical, my father's trying to calm everybody else down. You're the subject but not a participant in the conversation. And I had enough of those, and they'd had enough of those. And I got back together with Linda. I have a lovely wife, Linda. She just celebrated this month. She will have 39 years in Al-Anon. I am one of the more over-married alcoholics. I have a terrific wife. I have been a constant source of growth for her. I don't think she'd have half the program she has today if she wasn't married to me. And the 3 boys. I don't know what she did to get all 4 of us. I think must be a karmic sort of thing where she must have been a contagious prostitute in the 13th century or something like that to come back and get us. But she'd be here without question, and she gave me a pass to go to the lake for a couple of days, so I'm going to go to the lake after I leave here. I got that together with Linda, and we broke up for about the last year of my drinking, and I got a job as an executive trainee in manufacturing concern, bought my first car. I thought, wow, you're finally going to be a grown-up. Only I couldn't shut my drinking down. Now I'm in a company, and I'm the company drunk. I'm in a company of engineers. I use up my sick leave in the first 4 months at work. I'm falling asleep at my desk. I just, I am a basket case. Linda, so I'm really loaded, just had my face kicked in as a waiter, went to her at a party where she's got another date, walked up to her and said, "I'd like us to seriously consider getting married." And She agreed to meet me the next day, and she agreed to that cut awful plan. I have to remember that today when I'm sponsoring these guys, that I, you know, that Linda said, you know, she was at the time working as a psychiatric nurse in an alcohol ward. So but I'm in trouble. I quit that job. I take a sales job. I have the sales job a couple of months. A buddy of mine gets married. I go out, I don't know, about a four-day drunk, and I wake up a Thursday afternoon sometime in July of 1967, and I don't know if I have a job, a fiancé, or a place to live. I panic. All of a sudden, the recommendation that I call AA didn't seem like so nuts. I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and two men came out and talked to me. I talked to an awful lot of people trying to help me, a lot of experts, you know, a lot of church people. They usually ask you a lot of questions, and they'll make recommendations to your family afterwards. I thought that's what this was going to be like. I really did. And I went out, and I met one guy had 6 months, one guy had 6 years. And they sat me down in the booth. They said, "We're from AA. We had a drinking problem. We've found a solution in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'd like to share it with you and hope it's of some use to you. If it isn't, don't worry about it. For some reason, talking to new guys helps us stay sober." So it seemed like there wasn't any, and they told me their drinking stories. And within a relatively short period of time, I found myself identifying with them. And they changed my life. We have many traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the greatest ones of which is that we share our experience, strength, and hope, and not our ideology or our philosophy. We don't preach at each other. We don't teach at each other. And these two men altered my life that night in that booth. That night I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank twice after that night. Once after a month of sobriety on a business trip to the West Coast, I didn't call AA, and I got drunk and got in trouble. I came home, I had almost 3 months of sobriety, and Linda and I were married, and I drank on our honeymoon, which I think subconsciously I've been planning for some time. I didn't, wasn't conscious, but I'm pretty sneaky. And we honeymooned in Acapulco, you know, where the divers dive off those cliffs. I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. I couldn't. So I dove off the public landing, climbed up about 85 or 90 feet, split my swimsuit, cut my leg. I'm stuck on this cliff. Linda's going absolutely nuts. I mean, she is looking at this horse's ass, and she's trying to get the police to get me down, and they're... I'm watching the waves, and I'm trying to figure out whether to jump or dive, and I finally... figured out, screw it, and I dove, and God watches after fools and drunk, because I made it. If I would have jumped, I would have died. You have to get out 34 feet to hit the middle of the channel, and you can't jump. You can dive that way. You can't jump. I didn't know that. I might have known it intuitively, but I didn't know it deductively. And we started going down there with the kids on vacation, and our 10th anniversary, she gave me a picture of the chasm at La Quebrada. We were watching the divers one night at midnight, and she said, at the bottom of the picture, it said, "There but for the grace of God." And I said, "God, that's the dumbest thing I've ever done." And she said, "Bob, it's not even in the top 10. I don't know how you can share a life with someone and see it so differently. So I came home, and... I was embarrassed. I didn't want to go to the meeting. Didn't want to call Warren. And she said, "For God's sakes, call Warren." I have the same sponsor that I walked in the front door with, Warren McGinley. His name, he is 52 years sober. He is 87 years old. Debbie knows him well, and Jerry knows him, and Bob knows him. And he was a mailman, wasn't a very fancy man. I think today if you got him in a room, you wouldn't think he was a big book expert. We have lots of big book experts. We got lots of guys that have memorized the first 164 pages, and I wouldn't go on a fishing trip with them if they paid me. Please don't take that to mean that I don't revere our book, don't promote the study of the book. My sponsor, for me, was the book. He was the 12-step champion of the Uptown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. He must have done 30% of the 12-step work see Wally back there. Wally was up in our country for a while with the Yankees. But my sponsor was a heck of a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and just the perfect man. I have had the privilege of doing a lot of stuff in AA. I got to be a delegate. I've done a lot of 12-step work. I sponsor a lot of guys. And everything that I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous has just been following Warren around. I just copied him. And his wife sponsored my wife. And it was like Sam and Larry. You know, how many people do you think Sam and Larry helped? I mean, it's how many people do you think David and Grace helped? It is, you know, or Jerry or John or just, you know, we talk about principles above personalities, but I'm telling you, baby, we are a society of personalities who practice principles. I mean, it is, thank God for the personalities and the attraction of the people, of the Bob W's and the Millie, the people in this room. This people is full of personalities who have affected and changed lives of other people. And it's, I mean, there's a spirit, there's a life force. It isn't, you know, it is very cool. And so I started going to AA. I'm 24 by this time. I guess I was married. So our wedding anniversary is 1 week before my sobriety anniversary. So I've been married 39 years this December, and I'll be sober 39 years December 10th, and I wouldn't be married today if Linda wasn't an Alan, I don't think. My story is kind of tacky. I had problems in sobriety, and I know that most of you don't. And, but, you know, you get. And the gift for me, I liked AA from the moment I walked in. Gift. I felt at home. I like the people. I like the conversation. I felt we joke about potential, but I mean that wasn't a joke for me. I was always the guy. You know, mother always said, "Bob, you're not very bright. Dress well." I have tried to, but I was the guy. Always overdressed. Always tried to, you know, very socially astute, and we. But it gets old. I can get in Notre Dame. I can't finish Notre Dame. I can get in the Catholic Church, but I can't. You know, as soon as I found masturbation and booze, you know, I mean, that was I was in serious conflict with the church almost from the get go. And I'm in a great family, and I can't do family very well. And it seems like I can get in, but I just don't seem to have the stability. It's very extraordinary when you listen to Tim and you listen to Steve and you listen to Debbie, all the talk. We can often do the extraordinary. We can't do the ordinary. We can't do the ordinary. I mean, did you hear Tim talk about going to work? And I'll talk a little bit about that. We can't do that. I mean, the idea of doing the same thing tomorrow. I mean... I mean, but we are full of people who were near jet pilots, almost senators, you know, went broke from extraordinary heights, and we can't be potty trained. I mean, it is just, you know, I mean, it is phenomenal. It really is. And that's funny, but it's not funny, because it's still bedeviling many of us in the room. Not me, but many of us in the room are struggling. So the gift, I liked AA from the moment I came in. It was easy for me to go to AA. It was not easy for me to do the work, but because I kept coming, I had a series of problems that were bedeviling me, and I thought if I had the problem and AA had the answer, those problems ought to be resolved, and it might take a period of time. Hell, it might take a year. And I had a problem getting up in the morning. I later found out that it had something to do with when you went to bed, but at the time I was having the issue, I did not connect those two things. And I had money problems. I spent $300 or $400 more a month than I made in 1967. If you do that over a long period of time, you will end up in debt. I just want to report that to you in case you're running that one and you don't know where it goes, you know. Linda and I started to have kids, and I had great parents, but even great parents make mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the mistakes my parents made, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes my parents made and a bunch they never thought of. I was loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent with my children. Not proud or happy or pleased with that, but that's an accurate description. I come from four or five generations of alcoholism. I also come from three or four generations of rage. I have helped break the pattern of alcoholism in my family. I hope I have helped break the pattern of inappropriate anger and acting that out. And I had a gambling problem. It was more of a hobby. 4 or 5 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. It wasn't that big of a deal. It was, but I was making 7 or 8 grand a year playing backgammon, and it was like a second job. That's what kind of gambling has always kept me afloat. And I had some work. I had trouble going to work, and I had a little trouble staying at work, and I had a little trouble working at work. Other than that, I was a pretty good worker. And I had all these problems when I came in AA, and none of them made my first inventory. No, but isn't it true that we come in and we're not looking for those? I mean, I'm looking for the worst things that I had done, the things I'm most ashamed of, the things that separate me, the things that I don't want to tell anybody. Those were the things I had the most attention on. Those other things were kind of smaller items and didn't make the list. You know, you could have told me to put them on my list. They wouldn't have, you know, I might have put them on the list if I was told to. But my first year, I didn't have a very good sense of my defects of character. I started to get a pretty good sense of them after my first year. And my first year, I was on a honeymoon. I loved AA and everything about it, the people in it. I, you know, was learning about it and reading. I was stark raving sober. I was everywhere. And then my second year, I started to get in touch. And one by one, my issues would arise. And one by one, I would take them on and try to deal with them. And I would make a little progress, and then I'd go backwards. And then my third year, they started to bother me a little bit. My fourth and fifth year, and I'm going to talk a little bit about problems in sobriety. It's going to sound like my sobriety wasn't, that I wasn't very happy and it wasn't okay. That's not particularly true. You know, people get up here for their first anniversary and thank you for their lives. Then they get up here for your third anniversary and they tell you how sick they were the first 2 years. When you're through it, when you're past it, you can go back and see it in a way. We don't see it when we're in it. We don't see it when we're in it. So, you know, one by one, I take these issues on. And, you know, the early, one of the most important things that happened to me is I had a wall built around me so you couldn't see the unattractive things that went on in my life. Behind the wall, it said, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything about me, you'd hate me, and who knows, I hate me. I mean, who knows more what a lousy, crummy, insufficient, rotten person I am than me. I'm comparing my inside with your outside. That's kind of the view that we have, some of us. And I had to tear that wall down in order to really surrender and enter Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of us come here with a profound sense of uniqueness. If the edges are not knocked off that, you will only look for the differences. Okay? You will defend yourself, as Tim was talking about. You'll just, you know, say, not that, I didn't do that, I didn't do this. So you'll look for the differences. But my wall started to get chinks in it when I called Alcoholics Anonymous and continued in conversation with my sponsor, and I tore it all the way down to my fifth step, and I made a discovery. I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, not my experience, not my feelings. And when I discovered that, I started to have a sense of hope that what worked for you would work for me. You know what I wanted to find in AA? I wanted to find a Bob expert. I wanted to find someone so profoundly bright, so insightful that they could look through me. I didn't find that. You know what happened to me? Is I surrendered, I took step one, I became an alcoholic. When I became an alcoholic, I had 30 or 40 people surrounded me who knew about alcoholism and the solution to alcoholism. I had teachers and experts that I could talk to. And they served me. Then all of a sudden, during my third and fourth year, I'm looking for an expert on Bob again. All of a sudden, I'm starting to have issues that I don't think someone 2 years sober should have, so I start to build my wall back up. Thank you very much for having my drinking problem, but stay out of my sex life. Stay out of my marriage. Stay out of my gambling. Stay out of my money. Stay out of my work. Brick by brick, sober, going to 5 meetings a week, sponsoring guys, I build my wall back up. And I'm, you know, So I find myself in my sixth or seventh year of AA in trouble. And pretty active guy. And I care about how I live. And I'm trying to do a good job, and I'm in trouble. I am trying to resolve the gambling, the money spending, the, you know, all those sorts of issues, and I'm not doing very well. The new guy comes into the meeting, I get him a cup of coffee, I sit him down, he shares that bushel basket full of manure that everybody has when they come in, and I say, hey, baby, I know it's bad, but as bad as it is and as hopeless as it seems, you are in the right place. If you come here and you share that bushel basket full of manure and you get a sponsor, you get into the book and you start taking the steps, it's going to be okay. You see that guy over there? He's got 3 years. You're starting to hit it out of the park. His life used to be such a mess, you wouldn't believe it. I'm glad you're here. You're going to be okay. And then I get in the car at 11 o'clock at night and I drive home and I'd say, Bob, you've been sober 8 years. When are you going to be okay? You just bought a $400 sport coat at a store that you had a $600 bill at. When are you going to stop spending money you don't have to buy things you don't need to impress people you don't like? And Cecil Corrigo stole that. And I didn't know. When are you going to stop gambling? When are you going to learn how to work? Everybody knows how to work. When are you going to learn how to work? I didn't know. I had a problem. The problem was is I knew the answer was God. I knew the answer was to deepen the spiritual contact that I had and, you know, deepen that aspect of my program. The other thing that has saved my bacon in AA is I couldn't keep my mouth shut, so I've been sharing pieces of my life. I shared about 65% of what was going on with my sponsor, and I know in Texas you do 100%, and I think that's very cool. But I was only sharing about 65% of it with me. You don't see it. And you certainly don't see it as it is. And I knew from the old-timers, whom I have always admired and hung around, that they had more depth than I had. So I had to move in that direction. And I had a resentment and hang up about the church. I'd get in meetings of spirituality, and when it got too heavy, I just split. I'd go down. We had two meetings, and often we had the newcomer meeting downstairs, and if it got too spiritual upstairs, I just go downstairs. And there was a problem. I mean, I'd go knock on the door, and God says, who's there? I said, God is Bob. God says, what do you want? And I said, well, I mean, you're sober, baby, and my pants are on fire. I need help. And God's going to say, okay. And then I'm going to say what every person always wants to know, comes over to my house, you know, and late at night and got a problem, and they share the problem with me. Then they sit down and say, what do I do? So I'm going to say to God, what do I do? You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what God might ask someone like me to do. Get up in the morning. Go to work. Stay at work. Work at work. Be kind and loving and gentle to your wife and children. Get on a budget. That's a harsh word. I think it's an Al-Anon word that has leaked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And stop gambling. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out if you've got my list of defects of character. And my mind was, as soon as I clean my act up, then I can go to God. What's the use of going to God if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? So I was stuck in that place for almost 2 years. And I'm not thinking about drinking, but I'm thinking about shooting myself. And I don't know how serious I was, but I'll tell you, I was in a bad place. I just felt like a loser. I was so tired of being a loser. I just, you know, good starter, bad finisher, loser. And so out of desperation, I went back to the steps. In our area, we have 99% of our meetings are closed-up discussion groups. I never gave a talk at my A group till I was 24 years sober. We had one meeting a month that we had a speaker at, and it was always outside speakers. And so I'm into the steps. So now I go through the steps for the third time formally. boy, step one's easy. I mean, I'm powerless and unmanageable. Just an absolute no-brainer. You know what fooled me? Step two. Okay, I lost step two. I believed that for us, I could put my hand on a lie detector and you'd say, do you believe God's going to restore us to sanity? Yes. Needle doesn't move. Do you believe God's going to restore Bob to sanity? No. I'm 7 years sober. I'm on the down escalator walking up. I mean, I'm losing it. It is not, I got more problems now. I mean, I feel like I got to leave AA, go to Gamblers Anonymous, Spenders Anonymous, Rage Anonymous. I mean, everybody's, you know, I'm active. I'm doing a lot of 12-step work. Everybody's telling me what a good job I'm doing. I'm thinking, God, can't you see it? I'm dying inside. I'm going to meetings with you 4 or 5 nights a week, and they don't see it. And most of the time, I don't get into it. I'm busy enough, and I'm active enough that I'm not into it, but it leaks through in the morning. It leaks through at night. It leaks through at periods where I don't have my defenses on. And so out of desperation, you know, I had to regain the second step. And I started to see people with bigger problems than I had, with smiles on their faces, with dignity, walking through the fire that I was trying to avoid and walk around. And I came to believe that God would restore me to sanity. I took step three with my sponsor on in my knees in his office. We didn't do that much, but I started to go to conferences. I started to hear people talk about that. And I thought, what the hell, I'll try it. And I tried it. And then I said, my first 2 4 steps had been with clergy, and this one I was going to do with my sponsor. And I said, when I'm done, be careful, because whatever you recommend to me, I'm going to do. I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst lying next to a lake. I said, you could give me a test. I know what to do. I could teach the course. I just can't do it. I am so bloody tired of being in that position that I could just couldn't explain it to you. And I said, I think I'm ready to do whatever I have to do. That's how unhappy I am. Did my fifth step, cried, talked a little bit. And when I was done, one of the things he wanted me to do was go to a clinical psychologist. He said, Bob, you've got a lot of issues with money, failure, success, and work. And he said, I'm not an expert in this, but he said, I really do think it would help you to go talk to someone. So I, through a series of references, I got an industrial psychologist to work with a big stock brokerage firm. I went and called this guy up. He said, can you get your parents involved? I said, no. He said, they've been over-involved in my life. I said, if you can't help me without getting my parents involved, please refer me to someone who can. He said, we get your wife involved. I thought, oh, crap. Well, they see it so differently. Maybe more accurately, but we get your kids involved. I said, they're young. I didn't want them involved. I was ashamed of how I was occasionally with my children, but I did. And I started going to the psychologist, and very shortly after I was in that room, not too long, we're having a conversation. My company's going down the tubes. I'm going broke. I'm about to file. I don't know. I'm busting my ass 2-3 hours a day, and it just is not working. And it is. I'm in the real estate investment business, and I'm spending most of my days down playing backgammon down at the club. And this man looked at me, and he said, Bob, why are you so afraid of failing? And I wanted to hit him. I mean, it was just the reaction I had was a visceral reaction. And I said to him, look, you're a blank, blank doctor. I said, if you go bankrupt, you just take your little sign, walk down the hall, pound it on another door, and within 6 months you're making $100,000. I said, I'm about to lose everything I had. I said, nod your head up and down if you understand that. I said, I've lived in this city all my life. I'm in the real estate investment business. I've asked people to participate in my investments that I went to high school and college. I'm about to lose everything I had. And he looked at my wife, and he said, if Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you? My wife said, no. he asked at a building, and Peter and the kids said, no, he wouldn't lose. If you can't lose, you can't play. I've never been willing to lose. I'm willing not to play. I'm the guy in the football team that I have a uniform, I do the calisthenics, I do the locker room, but when they blow the whistle to block and tackle, I go up in the stands because I don't block and tackle. There are no stands in life. It is all playing field. Kept wondering why I had all these bruises on me. You know, if you're standing still in the middle of the field, you're apt to get hurt a little bit. And people who would know me well know that I'm reasonably well equipped, but I never finish anything. And think of all the meetings you go to, of the guys who just about get their wings in the Air Force, that just about get the job at vice president, that just about finish law school or get in law school or just about, you know, we just about lived. I mean, the price for alcoholism and drug dependency isn't much, it's just your life. You never get a chance to use your gifts. Your gifts never get out from under the piano. They're still under the piano and with the wrapping on them, with the ribbon on it. We don't even get them out of the box. And what I discovered in that meeting with the psychologist was fear. I had done 3 inventories. My fear had, you know, dogs, snakes, and tall buildings. I had zero insight into fear. I was afraid of being a father. I was afraid of being a husband. I was afraid of the responsibility. I was afraid of failure. I was afraid of success. You know, Chuck used to talk about the 3 fishes swimming in the ocean, and the one fish looked over at the other and said, isn't the ocean wonderful? And the other fish looked over and said, what's the ocean? I'm swimming in fear and don't know what it is. And not too long after that, I was home, and I had a horrible day where I got up late, went to work late, left early, got in a backgammon game, won $600, missed the meeting, missed dinner, came home, got in a fight with my wife, and slapped one of the kids. One of those days you'd like to have videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years can do for you. And I said, gee, it happened again. And I said, it happened again. Weren't you there? You know, it's your life. I said, yeah, I was there. But it's so habitual. It's almost as if I don't have to think about it or make any decisions. It's just like it's like I'm in a blackout. It's like an automatic. And all of a sudden I stopped and I realized that was a bunch of crap. My life was the way it was because I designed it the way it was. I sounded like I wanted to quit gambling. I wanted to gamble whenever the hell I wanted to gamble, for as much money as I wanted to gamble and not have problems with gambling. I wanted my wife and children's love and affection without spending time with them. I wanted money without work. Not a very good design. And all of a sudden I realize, I can picture the chair I'm in, that I had tried pretty bloody hard, not all that well, but pretty hard, to try to clean my act up, and I had failed, and for some reason, at that moment, that was okay. First time it was ever okay. Because you know what I thought I was? An asshole. It is difficult to become a non-asshole if you are an asshole. I don't like bad language. My wife would not approve of that, but ass is not the right word. Asshole is the right word. And I got down on my knees and I had a surrender. You know, my first experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is my surrender experience is I stood naked in front of my alcoholism. And I looked in a mirror, naked at my alcoholism, and it altered me. I drank twice after that, but it was never the same. That night, I stood naked in front of my life. It altered me. And I was given the opportunity to take the 6th and the 7th step of the program of AA. The 6th step said that we're entirely ready to have God, remove our defect of character. The 7th step said we humbly ask and remove our shortcomings. I had spent 8 years trying to get rid of them. I don't have the power to get rid of them. I have the responsibility. I am the pipe, not the well. It happens through me, not by me. A doctor doesn't heal. He creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. A farmer doesn't grow. He plants a seed, creates an environment, which growth can take place and God grows, and I don't change. I create an atmosphere in which change can take place. It's a spiritual attitude. Maybe the three requirements of being honest, open-minded, and being willing. The sixth and the seventh step. The surrender experience. And that night, out of my surrender experience, four of the major problems of my life disappeared that night. Such as the power of God and the power of the program. Now, I'm a guy who's made lots of promises and broken them all. And I knew that I had to put a structure in place. So I gave my wife my checkbook. And I started giving her the paycheck. She's not working at this time. And, she probably still was working at that time, but she was going to surely not have to. And she had us out of financial trouble in about 9 months. She could pay half of a bill. Goddamnedest thing I have ever... fancy technique that I had never heard of. And I started dating my wife. I've dated my wife every Friday night for the next 28 years. We stopped that, and things are a little dry right now, and I got to get back to that. But we travel so much together, and we take a lot of trips, that when I go home, we want to go see friends. And so we've broken that pattern, and I think we need to kind of get back. Our lives are kind of in flux because I'm getting a little older, and our pattern of where we are and where we're living and all that stuff is kind of changing. And I think part of the dryness is that I'm gone from my group so much. I don't feel as connected, you know, to the guys I sponsor and all that. You know, just change. And that's the direction I want to go. I don't want to stay home. Well, we want to, you know, Linda and I want to do a lot of different things, and we're going to do a lot of different things, and I'm going to have to keep my program intact through those changes, unless I decide not to do those changes. I have spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours trying to learn how to be a better parent. I think being a parent takes 125% of whatever you have. I think having children is like having a bowling alley installed in your head. It is just as one of the most demanding. It is one of the great privileges of life, but I think it taxes you. You know, our book talks about it. The 12 and 12 talks about it. We live our lives in relationships. I mean, if God wanted you to know what wasn't working in your life, how would he get the information to you? Bad news, probably your significant other. maybe the eyes of your children as you're screaming at them, maybe your boss, maybe your brother and sister, maybe your sponsor. But it's going to be in relationship. You know, most of us don't want the message. I quit gambling that night, and my life took off like it was on a rocket ship. For the next 10 years, everything I touched turned to gold. I started to make a lot of money, bought big houses, had two Mercedes, paid for it. This was my deeply shallow period. And I'm the guy in the very expensive suit and very expensive tie going to the meeting in his Mercedes, thinking that God has blessed him because of what a wonderful member of AA I was. How would you like to be in my group? There's problems with failure. There's problems with success. I became mildly, you know, I became arrogant and never knew I was, you know, I thought I had gratitude. I was just a loud asshole with money going, you know, it wasn't all that pretty, and it was, you know, it was what it was. And in 1986, they passed the Tax Act, and in between 1986 and 1991, I went broke. I lost $8 million. I lost the big house. I lost the Mercedes. I had the house paid for. You know, lost it. My dad used to be worried about me. He saw my pattern. He saw how I spent money. And I said, Dad, don't worry. It's okay. I mean, I'll never have to work again. And it wasn't okay. It wasn't stable. Now, this was a tsunami that hit the Tax Act of 1986. That change was not a small deal. There was more real estate loss than, you know, since the Great Depression. There has never been another time like that. You know, this was not an ordinary deal. And I crashed, baby. I was, I had asked a man to be my spiritual advisor. He said, what do you want? And I said, well, there's a man in Texas that I love by the name of Bob White. Everybody thinks they're Bob White's best friend. I said, I'm so competitive, I always want you to know how much I have, and I'm competing with you. I said, I want to stop that. I want to be less materialistic and more loving. Within about 6 months, I started to lose everything I had. We laugh about that. I said, we have to talk. Today, I wouldn't trade the lesson for the money. I'd take the lesson and the money. Not stupid. I mean, you know, that's... At that time, Peter came home from college. He got arrested for drunken driving, totaled on an automobile, and ended up in detox. It was kind of his Christmas present to Linda and I. And he goes through treatment. He goes to a halfway house. I'm going to the halfway house meetings. I walk in the meeting, and I start crying. I cry all the way through the meeting. Can't you just see, guys, see that guy over there? He's got 25 years. I don't think God had the real estate collapse just for me, but the lesson I was to learn during that was who I was with money and who I was without money. And I still have issues with money. I have issues with money, I have issues with eating. I know it doesn't look like I'm overweight, but I am. And but it's hard to practice the principles in all your affairs. None of us get perfect. What's the balance? How much are you, I mean, we're player coaches. It isn't like we're, you know, I mean, there are people that sound like they got it all down. No one owns this territory. This is living life. Okay? People sound like all you have to do is really get into the book and it'll be okay. Well, it isn't that simple. I was talking with Sandy Beach a couple of weeks ago. Sandy Beach was a jet pilot. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we just passed out instruction manuals on how to fly a jet? And if you really got into it, I mean, if you studied it for 5 or 6 years and read it every day and talked to people who flew jets, I mean, you should know how to fly jets, shouldn't you? No, but I mean, you would have read that manual 100 times. You would have talked to pilots. But one day, they'd put you in the goddamn seat, they'd turn it on, and you'd hear the engines, and you'd go, well, Jesus, what, you know, I mean, you'd go, what is, I mean, it isn't, I doubt that many of us could fly a jet by doing that. You know what I used to think recovery was? I thought recovery was the absence of problems. No one ever told me that. I made that up, and I didn't make it up to be a smartass. I thought that if you had a good program and you used these steps, your life would become in order. Many of the men and women who I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous, their lives appeared to be in order. Now, the fact is I was kinder on them than I was on myself. It wasn't like my sponsor was flawless. My sponsor was a very real guy. I've seen him fight with his wife. His wife was very real. I used to get knocked down arguments with her regularly. And, you know, but I was hard on myself, more easy on other people. Life is not the absence of problems. You know, recovery is not the absence of problems. What the program gives us is a way to deal with life on life's terms, which we have been significantly unable to do. One time I was down at the lake, and Bob White was coming up to Dallas to give an AA talk, and I'm driving him up, and he's saying, I really don't feel like giving an AA talk. He said, you know, I don't like... Bob White was not the best public speaker. He was a good public speaker. The talk, if you ever get Bob W. at Canyon Conference, the best. But he was as powerful a man in a room with a group of other people. Chamberlain was powerful both ways, and Bob could be, but... He said, you know, the only reason I talk today, he said, you know, when you get older, past 30 years of sobriety, he said, you get to talk about what you want to talk about, because you're not trying to impress anybody. You're kind of over the hill and, you know. And so he said, that's why I do it. And Bob used to like to talk about the power of being added. You know, Vinoy talked a little bit about that at the end of her talk. And I'm going to spend the last 10 minutes that I have in my talk talking about change. And it's a program of change. What I was told when I came in there, they told me alcoholism was a disease, physical, mental, spiritual. When I crossed the line from problem drinking to alcoholism, my alcoholism affected me all the time when I was drinking and when I was not drinking. The idea that my alcoholism could affect me when I was not drinking was a brand new idea. That was like rocket science. The idea that Tim talked about just 24 hours, that is so profound. Most of us don't even get close to how deep the idea of one day at a time is. I wish we'd get back and understand the strength and power and dimension of living in the day, living in the moment, being present. Pretend for a moment that I'm sponsoring a guy who's 40 years old, married with kids, and he's having trouble doing the fourth step, and he's having trouble with the columns. And I go to him and I say, look, Harry, don't worry about it. It's kind of complex. I got a new thing I want to try. Just get your wife, your mom and dad, your brothers and sisters, your boss, a couple of neighbors, a couple of guys from the group, and bring them over to the house. And here's what I want you to say to him. I want you to say, we have a step in AA where we try to get in touch with our defects of character, and I'm having trouble identifying mine, and I wish you'd help. You have a pretty good start. Most of us wouldn't call that meeting. You know why? We don't want to change. We're afraid of change. Scott Peck, a man, wrote a book called Road Less Traveled. Very good book. Later he wrote a book called Further Along the Road Less Traveled, and in that book he talks about the five stages of death and dying. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. You know, denial is maybe I don't have cancer. You know, anger, what, God, why are you doing this to me? Bargaining is, God, please remove this, and I'll dedicate my life to you. And then depression, I'm talking about circumstantial depression, not trying to play doctor. Appropriate, depression, appropriate to the circumstance that you're in. And he said most people think when they hear the five stages of death and dying that people who die go through that, all five stages. They don't. They go through denial, anger, and bargaining, but when they get into the depression, the pain is so great, they back away and they recycle into denial, anger, and bargaining. He said, interestingly enough, it's similar with major changes in our lives. We don't view change as just change. We view it like dying. The problems that we have in the room are not new. Anybody have any new problems? They're old problems. They're patterns. They're old patterns of thinking. Okay? And the reason that we don't change them is we think it's us. That's who I am. It's not us, it's behavior. It's changeable. You can change from a Republican to a Democrat, and it doesn't change who you are. The program of change is not external, it is internal. It is transformational. It is not about doing, which is what we always want the answer to what we do. It's about being. When you change who you be, or you go back to getting in touch with who you be, everything else flows from that. What you do flows from that. Today, we have so many experts in the book and steps. And I think, in one way, it's a sign of growth of our fellowship. In another way, it's a movement towards orthodoxy. And I don't always think movements towards orthodoxy are powerful. And we give the impression that if you just do these things, I mean, if the steps were mechanical, all you'd have to do is anytime you had a problem, say the third step prayer and click your heels, you'd be back in Kansas. No, I'm serious. And it isn't as if the third step doesn't work. I'm just saying sometimes no one's home. The steps are spiritual. No one owns them. No one's an expert on them. You know why we don't, we argue about the traditions all the time? We don't argue about the steps. You know why? They're too profound. We respect them too much. No one owns them. No one contains them. But we're starting to sound like you can become an expert on the book. You can become an expert on the book. You just have trouble becoming an expert on living. And in that process, the changes that we're looking for are in the heart, not the head. They are not informational, they are experiential. They are of God, and no one owns that territory. And it is new to all of us. When your daughter gets in trouble, when our three boys get in trouble, my wife and I are crying in our room, praying ourselves to sleep at night. We don't know what to do. Mr. AA could have been a big enough asshole striking my children that they did not want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous when they got sober because of me. Wouldn't that have been cool? Gives a hell of an AA talk. His life sucks, but a great talk. You know. Life is pithy. Okay. The journey of a spiritual journey is a process that as you go forward into it, you run into what's in your way. You run into what's going to stop you. That's why the profound relationships of a son to a, or daughter to a parent, from parent to children, from spouse to spouse, the unavoidable relationships are so profound. They're unavoidable. You don't get to just walk out of them. And by the way, I think your love story with your wife is just extraordinary. I think that is a great story. I mean, there is the tie that binds underneath all that external stuff, you know, that people are still willing to take a look at the connection and the and what they share in life, and it's so powerful. My partnership with my wife is, and I wouldn't have made it through my bankruptcy without my wife and AA. I would have blown my brains out. I went to my, I was looking for a gun. I was 25 years sober, sucking my thumb under my desk in the fetal position. Don't get the impression that I floated through that period of time. I was in as much pain for 2 or 3 years as I've ever been in my life. Losing my money was not like changing my clothes. It was like tearing the skin off my body. If any of you are out there praying to become a millionaire, include the idea of keeping it. Just, you know, a lot of guys don't include that when they're praying, you know, to make $1 million. When I was young in AA, I tried to change and I failed. I tried and failed. I tried and failed. And I tried and failed, but I still grew. There comes a time where you either change or you stop growing. I don't know when that is. The church used to talk about it when you become to the age of reason. I don't know what the age of reason is for an alcoholic. But there's a parallel in there someplace. And we get to that point, and you either change or you start to accommodate the problem to your life. You build an addition onto your house to house the problem. You make a deal with the guys that you're in the group with and say, look, we'll talk about the steps, the traditions, the concepts, the media, you stay out of my face, I'll stay out of yours. Deal? Not a good deal. The mark of what it is to be a good AA is not just what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. The mark of what it is to have a good program is the mark of how it is at home, in your community, at your work, with in your extended family, and with your friends. It is in life. A lot of us are hiding in AA, and we bring out our merit badges to show what great members we are, almost as a proof that we do not have to make any further changes. I use my 30 years of sobriety. Stay out of my face. I got 30 years. Well, you know, can you have problems with 30 years? Yeah. Is that an indication you have a poor program? I don't think so. If you're breathing, you have problems. And the process of life and the process of spiritual growth will bring them to you as you go through that process, and then our choice is whether or not we can stand in front of them, see them what, for what they are, is not an essential part of us. See our walk for what it is. It's a walk towards connection with God, the God of our understanding, our higher power. The process of finding God is a process of coming home. There is nothing missing. We are whole and intact. It is a journey to where we began. As Chuck talked about what you are looking for, you are looking with. The process of finding God is a process of removal. We have taken this perfect magnet that is our soul and heart and dragged it through the junkyard of life, and we show up in AA with a ball of metal about this big. And through doing step work and through conversations and through all the service that we do, piece by piece, we pry the external, extraneous pieces out until a little ray of light comes through. Chuck used to talk about everybody right now, even the man committing rape in the street. I remember when he said it to me, my head is doing the best he knows how to do according to his light. When he has more light, he will do better. When we knew, we did better. When most of us knew, when most of us surrendered, we never took another drink. It wasn't just information. It wasn't just facts. Something hit us in a way that we were altered. We were transformed, and we never took another drink. Change in AA, having had a spiritual awakening, what happens to us? We become more awake as a process of taking the steps. I still have an issue with anger. I still have an issue with money, but it doesn't run my life like it used to run my life. I don't hurt the people around me with the consistency and depth that I used to hurt the people around me. Perfect? Oh, God, no. Better? Yeah. In the game, you betcha. And that's what it is. Thank you for my life.